Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, what odds would you put on Dominic Cummings disappearing from British public life and never being seen again?
Well, Jimmy, I actually... does it not feel like this is his last hand to be dealt, going to the select committee and doing that 7-hour... It did feel like a 7-hour rant, really, in front of his questioners and being broadcast to the United Kingdom and the world. I'm not sure... I think that this is, like, his last hurrah, and I'm not sure what else he can offer other than... butter up Rishi Sunak and try and get in when he's Prime Minister. But that's about it, really, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's felt like that every single time he's appeared to exit the stage. So it felt like that after the Brexit referendum, he sort of disappeared and posted some retrospective, very wordy blogs, and occasionally popped up on Twitter to say something. It felt like that when he resigned last October as well.
It was pushed out, as some people would have us believe.
It sort of felt like that even in after the general election in 2019. There was a sense he wasn't going to stay around very long because he seemingly briefs the press that he's on the point of resigning every week, basically. Mm-hmm. You can save your jokes about me for later in the podcast. I still think he's more likely to come back than not. I mean, you've already mentioned Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor who escaped criticism during Dominic Cummings.
And garnered praise.
Yes, even. I don't think, in some ways, I don't really think Dominic Cummings is the sort of person to flatter somebody into giving them a job. I mean, he's not really the sort of person to flatter anybody, seemingly. Jazza is looking super sceptical.
I'm not sure that's true.
Okay. So this is, of course, the story that Dominic Cummings has appeared in front of a select committee and tried his best to demolish Boris Johnson's government and various cabinet ministers, but not all of them, which is something I'm sure we're going to get into in our first segment in this podcast. Mm-hmm. Jazza, we meet every fortnight to discuss politics, current issues and social affairs. So what are the two other topics that we are going to cover this week?
The second one is something that I think you're really going to have to convince me to care about, because it is regarding the, 1996 Princess Diana interview with BBC journalist Martin Bashir. Apparently shit went down. Bashir faked some documents that led to Diana, Princess of Wales, being coerced, I guess,
tricked.
Convinced,
manipulated,
tricked. Oh my god, look at us thesauruses.
Yeah.
Into doing the interview, which was really blew the whole kind of royal family wide open, where she famously talked about Charles's infidelity in their relationship. And people seem to be talking about this as if it didn't happen like 25 years ago. Like it's a quarter of a century ago this happened. And there's also some suggestions that, if Bashir had never done this, then she'd have never left Charles and everybody, and she'd have never died. And I don't think that's true. However, you're going to convince me to care? I was like five when this happened, 5-6 years old when this interview came out. I have no memory of it really, and I'm sure it was very important for young princes Harry and William, because it's about their mum, and everybody who reads the Express will obviously be obsessed with this. Yeah, I don't really care.
I mean, you're not really selling this topic, although I think you inadvertently have, because what we've got here, we've got BBC bashing, which is always fun to talk about, especially mm-hmm. in the context of the, whether they're going to shift to a subscription model and throw away the licence fee, as the Tories always love to encourage. We've got the royal family, which we like talking about, in particular, the changing relationship of, or maybe not changing, the relationship between the royals and the media, I think, is interesting. Particularly given our respective positions on the monarchy, Jazza, I assume that yours still hasn't changed.
Mine is I don't care enough to change it.
Continual lukewarm support.
Yeah. I think in that sense, I do mirror quite a lot of the British public way.
I think yours is the normal, the default position among the British people. There's stuff in there. I think we can see if we can skirt away from a big ding dong on whether we should abolish the royal family.
Ding dong.
And I can just talk about journalism for 15 minutes, and that's what the listeners come for, right? So, what's our third topic, Jazza? Could you try and sell this one a little bit more than the previous efforts?
Oh, I think that this is, I kind of want us to do something a little bit more reflective than anything and kind of look into the future, because this week, or the last week that we had, saw the 1 year anniversary of the death of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd. That video that went around the internet, and because we were all locked down and inside, we had no choice but to watch it, and it's changed an awful lot of things. Some statues have been pulled down in the UK, some legislation is in the process of being passed in the United States, and surprisingly, an American policeman has been prosecuted for murdering a civilian.
Successfully prosecuted.
All of those are significant things, and his death, albeit obviously it goes without saying horrific, really has kind of like created a mass awakening of a new generation of people involved in activism and politics, and that is truly truly significant, and I think we should mark that, and Jimmy can probably say some inappropriate things.
So that was a much better job. I'm pleased that you really put your back into that one. Shall we play some music, talk about the Patreon account, and get on with talking about Dominic Cummings?
Yeah, we can. Let's go.
If you are a fan of the Right Dishonourable podcast, you can support us by going to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. There you can subscribe to us on an episodic basis, which gives you access to exclusive segments that we do not release to anybody else. Our current patrons include Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt, and Michael Costa. Thank you very much for supporting the show. Also, if you don't think you're getting enough from me on this podcast, you can read my weekly newsletter on politics and other things at jdenichols.substack.com. Also, you can watch Jazza play Pokemon on his YouTube gaming channel, which for some reason can be found at youtube.com/JazzaInChina. That's probably enough advertising for one episode, so now on with the show.
Jimmy, when obviously you've tuned into all 7 hours of the broadcast of Cummings being interrogated,
that goes without saying. I've nothing better to do.
No, obviously, I think we all know that by default. At what point? I actually did watch quite a lot of it. don't tell my daytime boss. At what point did your jaw hit the floor?
I don't think.
Did it hit the floor, or were you just standard Jimmy Nichols fare of just like?
I don't think anything was that surprising, really. Like, I mean, there were some great headlines within it. Particularly.
I was like, what are people going to choose from the cacophony of things that he's splurting out at the moment?
Yeah, well, some people made the point that one of the advantages for targets of Dominic Cummings is that he attacked so many people that a lot of these, allegations that would have been, running for days afterwards are just going to be lost in the sleuth.
He should have done more of a drip, shouldn't he?
I think so. I think, he maybe should have said, oh, I'll come and do like an hour this week, an hour next week, an hour spread out the headlines, I would say. But that's not really
his
select
committee.
Style.
I can slot you in between 2 and 4. and then like an Asda delivery turn up at like 4:30.
Yeah, sure. I think the best headline for me was probably where he said Boris Johnson was unfit to be prime minister.
Yeah, and that I think that was one of the things where I was just like, oh my bloody God.
Well, even better than that, which is somewhat related, is he complained about the British public having to choose between Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson in December 2019 for the general election. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you're sitting there thinking, but you masterminded Johnson's campaign, so mm-hmm. you should at least think he's all right.
Yeah, this is your fault.
Yeah, I mean, if you think they're both really shit, I mean, I get that you... I get that you might say, well, I dislike Corbyn, I dislike Johnson, but I prefer one mildly over the other, so I'm going to vote for them. But to run a campaign in favour of like one of them when you think they're that shit is quite something. But Cummings is a mm-hmm. weird guy, right? So maybe we shouldn't be too surprised that he made that odd decision.
I was also very shocked when he continuously kept on saying that Matt Hancock, the health secretary, should have been fired at multiple points, and said that he was lying internally within the halls of government regularly about his department's capabilities to do things like, for example, make sure that people were tested for coronavirus before they were sent back to care homes, for example. Mm. We knew at the time, for goodness sake, that that was not happening and resulted in tens of thousands of people dying because of that mismanagement. Do you think... There was a suggestion by him as well that Boris Johnson was keeping Matt Hancock around because then he'd be able to fire him afterwards?
Yeah, in the subsequent inquiry.
Hmm. He doesn't seem to... The inquiry, by the way, I believe doesn't get published until 2025 or 2026 or something along those lines.
It'll be after the next general election. So.
What a fucking surprise. I don't think that all of those people are going to be in those jobs in 5 years' time, do you?
No, it seems pretty unlikely.
But also, Boris Johnson maybe could have... focused on this critique of Matt Hancock and sacrificed him to the Dominic Cummings gods. God, it's a monotheistic religion. And he's decided not to, really, and kind of backed him. And I don't know what I was expecting there, but it's an interesting thing that he decided not to throw Matt Hancock under the bus.
Well, I don't think he could have very easily. I don't think he could have, because it's not as though any of what Cummings said should have been news to Boris Johnson. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, if mm-hmm. to say,
yeah, he was there too.
Yeah, exactly. So to say, like, oh, well, now Cummings has said it publicly, I suppose I need to fire Matt Hancock.
It also legitimates a lot of the stuff that he said. And if he legitimates Matt Hancock... apparently, allegedly lying and being incompetent at his job, then it also gives legitimacy to the critique of Boris Johnson being woefully unqualified. Although, does anybody disagree with that? I have yet to find anyone who does.
Well, I mean, I think you might have brought this up in a previous podcast, actually, when the Hartlepool by-election was going on. And, you know, I think there was some surveying done about how, you know, people felt the Boris Johnson had handled the pandemic. And is it not true that a majority of people think that he's done an okay job? A majority of the British public, I think.
Since the vaccine, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is. That's largely based on the success of the vaccine rollout. Mm-hmm. But I think even though me and you in our particular metro elitist bubble think that Boris Johnson is incredibly incompetent and is very ill-suited to handle a public health emergency like this, our opinion is the unusual one. I mean, I assume most of our listeners will probably agree with us on that point, but it is worth saying that a lot of people think he's done an okay job. And I guess probably the strongest line of defense, to back that idea up, is to look at the examples of other more conventional political leaders in, say, France and Germany. And I think you can say that on balance, you know, most of Europe has done quite badly in terms of dealing with this pandemic. I mean, if you compare European performance with, say, South Korea, Europe looks incredibly incompetent in dealing with this
pandemic.
Taiwan
kept on being brought up by Dominic Cummings as well.
Yeah.
As an example. And I thought it was very interesting that he You know what? There was very little I disagreed with Dominic Cummings on in this whole thing. Like, I was just like, oh, yeah, I agreed that the delaying lockdown was a really bad idea. And I'm like, oh, I agree. Everybody did know that herd immunity was the plan. We heard people within government refer to it and say it, and people were being briefed about herd immunity. Mm. All we were bloody talking about at the very beginning was herd immunity, despite nobody really understanding what it meant, thinking that it just meant it vaccinate every that it just meant infect everybody rather than vaccinate everybody, which is usually what herd immunity means when it comes to human pandemics anyway. I agreed with the fact that Boris Johnson is incompetent. I agreed with the fact that Matt Hancock is a bit of a shit. But the difference is, Dominic Cummings was there and supposedly was meant to have some kind of a sway in the situation, and seemed, and he himself apologised for not for thousands of lives lost because of his incompetency. I was also kind of shocked about that as well.
He apologised right at the start, didn't he?
Big so apology. Straight off the bat. Sad boy.
I think it's, like, I mean, a lot of people thought the apology was a bit disingenuous given his, you know, continued role in a lot of this. But I think...
Well, maybe he just didn't have the power that a lot of people assumed that he did.
Well, in a sense, Dominic Cummings had very little power, in the sense that he only really had influence. I mean, somebody said that he was, you know, the most influential figure in government as, you know, somebody who, I mean, they didn't use the word influential, but because he was felt to have the ear of Boris Johnson, people say, well, he was kind of the power behind the throne, basically. But in terms of his formal power, he had almost none, I don't think. None that wasn't delegated to him by Boris Johnson. So I guess it's kind of, I mean, I suppose you could somewhat say that's true of cabinet ministers anyway, in that they have to retain the confidence of the prime minister. But, you know, ultimately the buck stops with Boris Johnson. It doesn't really stop with anyone else. So, I mean, Dominic Cummings could sort of like plead and argue and try and convince and persuade people, which are not necessarily things that are massively within his skill set, I think it's fair to say, given his... you know, the general dislike that he inspires from other people. But yeah, I'm not entirely sure where I'm going with this, but it's, you know, he was just an advisor at the end of the day. So
do you think that there is any, what's going to happen? Because nothing has in like the 4 or 5 days, absolutely nothing on the Sunday kind of like the Sunday papers programs. None of them were really talking about the Dominic Cummings stuff, and it was less than a week afterwards. Was this not just like a little bit of catnip for us political junkies, for us to have in the background while we did our work? That's how I watched it anyway. And then for it to just like blow away in the wind?
Yeah, well, I guess, like, even though it has been very entertaining to read about or to watch, how much
it was entertainment at like its best. It was political entertainment.
Yeah, it was,
but at its best.
How much of it was news, honestly? Like,
exactly right. We knew all of it.
We knew 90% of a lot of this, I would say. I mean, you know, it's good. Sometimes it's good to hear such things from the horse's mouth, but I think it's, you know, it's widely known that a lot of the reporting around the COVID response was based on leaks from within government, and, you know, a fair portion of it appears to have been coming from Dominic Cummings. He claims that he mostly spoke to Laura Koonsberg. That was his main, the political editor of the BBC, that was his main person to converse with. But, I mean, I'm sure he spoke to other people, right? Like, it seems he's quite... I mean, he used to work for The Spectator, apart from anything else. Mm. So I'm sure that his briefing, well, the briefings from him and some of his, you know, vote leave companions within Downing Street, I'm sure went further than just Laura Koonsberg. But yeah, I mean, most of this stuff, like, I mean, everyone knows that him and Johnson had a big falling out, which is what ultimately led to his resignation. There have been a lot of stories about the influence of Carrie Symonds, who's now Boris Johnson's wife, but who was previously his fiancée during the course of the pandemic. And yeah, like, we know that she's had inappropriate influence on some of the, or it's been alleged she's had inappropriate influences on some of the appointments going on in Downing Street, and had a role within, with Dominic Cummings resigning last year as well. I mean, the Matt Hancock stuff, I think it's not exactly news that the track and trace system was a total botched job, really. So, I mean, I suppose one interesting thing that came up out of this was the infamous flight, Dominic Cummings' flight to Durham and to his excursion to Barnard Castle.
Flight in a car, not a literal air flight.
Yes, yeah. Yes, fleeing from London.
As in flee, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he now claims that he was facing death threats, or, you know, threats to the health and safety of his family in London. I guess, do you believe that? Do you think that's true?
I thought it was one of the least interesting things, because that's all. That's another thing that we've kind of gone over an awful lot. And I think that most people have, again, already priced that into their political decision-making. Mm. This is the thing. I actually had a conversation with a friend of mine who currently works at a large news broadcaster.
Oh. Mm. How is Tom Harwood doing these days?
No, it's not him. can confirm, not my source. And he was like, and is feeling very jaded about the whole whether or not he wants to continue in journalism, because he's like, we're giving people all of this information, like, be it the there was nothing secret about, like, the overt racism and incompetence of Trump. There was nothing secret about the incompetence of this government at the beginning of the pandemic. But people just don't seem to care, no matter how good the journalism is and how much transparency there is. And it was a big theme of Dominic Cummings' performance on Wednesday. Where he talked a lot about there should have been more transparency within the decision-making, about the decision-making that was happening in government. And I broadly agree with him, I think. But there's no point in transparency and good reporting, really, you could argue, if people at the end of the day don't take it into consideration and don't care. I don't know how we stop people from being apathetic.
I mean, is it true they don't care?
If you look at the, I think with the performance of across the country at the local elections, I would have expected, based on the performance of this government and its response to the pandemic and the number of people who have died because of bad decisions that they made, I would have expected them to do a little worse.
But I think that I think it's illogical to assume that just because you report on the incompetence of government that is necessarily going to lead to the opposition party in this instance, or opposition parties picking up more votes in the next election. That doesn't follow at all, because yes, you know, a lot, you can look at the government and say they did a lot of stuff wrong during the pandemic, but that doesn't necessarily mean you want to elect their opponents in the next time. You know, you can still have the view that actually, even though they, you know, Boris Johnson was incompetent, and, you know, his government did make a lot of bad decisions, you can, I mean, some people, I think, argue, essentially the point I made slightly earlier, that actually a lot of European governments did badly, and it wasn't, a huge proportion of the deaths are probably just due to European society's not being very well set up to deal with pandemics like this, you know, compared to a place like South Korea. And I guess the other thing is, you might still think, well, yeah, okay, this current Conservative government is bad, but can the Conservative Party in general still better represents my politics and values than Labour do? I don't really think that follows. I also would say, I think there's a lot of examples of the reporting having a tangible impact. I mean, something that I think has repeatedly come up is that even before the government was locking down back in March 2020, most of us were already making decisions about what to do with our lives, you know, and we were already guarding against our own safety before the government acted. Also, the Barnard Castle story is a great example of the power of journalism to affect how, you know, how politics develops. I mean, the amount of anger around the Barnard Castle story was huge, and I think it ultimately would have contributed to Dominic Cummings leaving the government. I know it didn't at the time.
It took 6 months. I don't think it affected that. I think the only thing that the Barnard Castle story resulted in was people being like, well, if they don't adhere to the rules, then why the fuck should I?
Mm.
I think that's the only result that it had. And you'd hope that it had some kind of a repercussion in terms of getting the people who are hypocritical in their actions out of office. But the thing is, Dominic Cummings wasn't elected. He's the Prime Minister's stooge.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know.
I admire your optimism about journalism as a profession, and if not you, then who, you know?
Well, okay, so you once said to me, we were once discussing whether if journalism didn't exist, how bad would it be for, like, the state of Western governance more broadly? And you said it would be a little bit more corrupt. And that sounds like quite, you know, it's got like quite a modest aspiration, but I think in that sense it's still worth doing. Do you know what I mean? If you're looking for a public,
so honourable. I love you.
Public life justification. It doesn't have to, like, change things. It doesn't have to fix things entirely,
just,
right?
As long as there's some kind of Jimmy, I just want to give you a big hug. We're allowed to now as well.
We are.
Can I give you one more, despite the fact that nobody knew that they weren't able to hug? But anyway, one more thing before we move on to more journalism and you get to gush about your profession quite disgustingly everywhere. How much do you think the announcement of the secret Carrie Simmons and Boris Johnson wedding yesterday was used as a way of being able to seize the front pages of all of the Sunday papers so that the papers had something other than Dominic Cummings to write about?
I think you're being a little bit too cynical.
Do you think I've got my tinfoil hat on? I think that's 100% what has happened. Because I know that you were like, oh, but literally less than a week ago, it was there were reports, quote unquote, that RSPVs for the Johnson-Simmons wedding had been sent out for something like June 2022, so next year. And there were even comments from people in the weddings industry. I hate that that's an industry. The wedding industry saying that this is going to really affect our bottom line in the next few months because of the fact that even the Prime Minister has postponed his wedding until next year. And then a few days later, after there's like a huge amount of fallout from Dominic Cummings basically saying, look at these idiots and how incompetent they all are. Then Carrie Simmons goes, hey, you know what? Let's steal some headlines and just get married in secret and then tell everybody that we got married in secret. I 100 call me a conspiracy theorist, but I 100% believe that's what's happened.
Well, you are a conspiracy theorist because you are alleging a conspiracy, but some conspiracies are true.
Excellent.
So
love that. I'll start a Reddit thread.
However, so this story that Boris Johnson was going to be married in next summer basically came via Harry Cole and the Sun, and I think it's worth noting. I don't know if this gives the story
that Carrie Simmons has really, really bad taste in men.
Yeah, so Carrie Simmons used to date Harry Cole before, sometime before she dated Boris Johnson.
She could do so much better.
I mean, she's dating the she's married to the Prime Minister, so I'm not sure
that's necessarily punching up. Do you know what I mean?
It is in a social climbing sense, I suppose, if nothing else. But that story did come out, and obviously it's been, events have subsequently proved it to be wrong. But, I mean, in your impression of Boris Johnson's relationship with Carrie Simmons from the reporting of the press and the leaks coming out of Downing Street, do you really think that he would be able to convince her to move their wedding, you know, allegedly one of the most important and special days of any woman's life, to a particular
or
weekend?
Man's, Jimmy.
Or Matt, I mean, come on, let's be real about this. Just for the sake of political expediency.
I think it was her idea.
You think it was her idea? You mm-hmm. think that she's so consumed by controlling the press narrative that she would 100%,
do that? Especially, we didn't even talk about this, her being obsessed with that story about her dog on the day that they were trying to figure out whether or not they were going to go into lockdown or bomb Iraq.
Mm.
That came out in the Cummings inquiry as well.
That did come out. Dominic Cummings said that she had asked the Downing Street press office to basically try and get this story revoked in the Times, and it was taken offline eventually. And it was about Dylan the dog was going to be put up for adoption because Boris Johnson didn't like it, basically.
Or wasn't it something about it pissing in a pot or something?
It has been accused of violating a lot of furniture in the Downing Street house. So
good.
You could use your own imaginations for what that might entail. Mm-hmm. I suppose it's vaguely possible, but it doesn't. I think the more likely explanation is that they just decided to get married because they wanted to get married. I think your conspiracy theory is not that likely.
I don't believe that Boris Johnson loves anyone
but himself,
let alone honestly. Himself.
Let alone himself. Mm. Interesting. I think that's a thread we may have to pick up on another excellent. Day.
Oh yeah, feel free to quote me on that as well. Out of context if possible.
Okay, so speaking of more journalistic things, as you said, we're now going to turn to the Martin Bashir scandal at the BBC.
Mm-hmm. Jimmy, can you give me a rundown of what actually happened? What documents did he fake that then caused Diana, Princess of Wales, the people's princess of people's hearts and the people's minds and hearts, and I don't think I'll ever be queen. she's a dead lady, I probably shouldn't do that. What happened?
So basically in 1995, Martin Bashir was trying to get an interview with Princess Diana. It was widely known that her marriage with Princess Charles had hit had hit the rocks. And basically Martin Bashir commissioned commissioned a graphics designer at the BBC who was freelancing for the corporation at the time to mock up some fake bank documents to try and indicate to Diana that she was being spied on, I think, and that there were shenanigans going on. And these were then shown to Earl Spencer, who was Princess Diana's brother. And this was used to kind of ingratiate Martin Bashir with the Spencer family in a wider sense and try and secure this interview. Diana wanted to give an interview basically to somebody, and the BBC was the channel that she ended up going with. And as you said, this interview was a huge deal. Princess Diana admitted having an affair, also talked about Prince Charles's affair with Camilla Parker Bowles, who is now Prince Charles's wife, and she said that famous quote,
there's three of us in this marriage.
Yeah, so it was rather crowded. Which I think is like an incredible line. Whatever you think about the whole Diana saga, it doesn't fit. It feels as though that wasn't improvised. Let's say. It's basically the BBC, and then the BBC. There was a Mail on Sunday investigation into this after the interview was broadcast, because various journalists thought that there was something fishy about the interview, or they had like a gut feeling, and the Mail on Sunday actually managed to track down the graphics designer who subsequently his freelance contract was not renewed with the BBC after he'd kind of attempted to whistleblow on what had happened in the setup to the Bashir Diana interview. And then it was kind of covered up at the BBC, including by Tony Hall, who I think went on after to be Director General of the BBC. Mm. The wrongdoing in that is obvious, and the cover up is also bad. And now this report by Lord Dyson has come out and confirmed a lot of these details. As you say, this is like 25 years ago that these events took place, and I don't know how relevant it is to how the BBC is currently run. I personally don't think it is very relevant because so much time has passed and so much has changed at the BBC anyway in terms of how you know, news is handled. I mean, the BBC now is infamous for reporting on itself when things go wrong, which is...
I think it's actually, you know what, pretty good at reporting on itself. And I think that the BBC has made a bigger deal, has reported more on it than I've seen on other, like, news outlets. Mm. Anyway, there's been a lot less a bashing of the BBC than I would expect, but maybe that's because I live in a little echo chamber.
Maybe, I think the BBC is quite now is in many ways quite good about talking about its failings now, and that seems to be a part of the culture.
Well, as you, I guess, perfection comes with practice.
That's awful. Jazza, I've noticed you in the background. You've been opening up a copy of Private Eye. I assume you're about to regale me with some tale from there.
Not really. Just kind of. So an interesting thing that comes up in some of the reporting is it's actually the front of their most recent the first article within the pages of their most recent issue of Private Eye talked about, and I think displays so weirdly the strange balancing act that the royal family and those in its periphery, in periphery, including the Spencer family, including specifically Earl Spencer, who was Diana, Princess of Wales's brother, how they on one hand are like, leave us alone, press, we want privacy and your desire to have an inside scoop into our lives is damaging our lives. And I think that there are, especially from Earl Spencer and from Diana's children, the Princess Harry and Prince William, I think has been the most vocal about it. There's been nothing explicitly said, but there's been the suggestion that this was the stone that got kicked down the hill and set the ball rolling on Diana eventually losing her life in that car accident where she was being followed by paparazzi. And that's a bloody stretch, guys. Like, obviously, this is a bad thing to have happened for... this is obviously a bad thing that the BBC did and Bashir did. I can't believe that somebody who is a journalist who works for a BBC that is so up its own arse, frankly, about how high its journalistic standards are, thought that this was a bloody good idea in order to just get Diana on an interview. But then there's kind of like all of these critiques from Lord... from Earl Spencer saying that they don't want to kind of like be involved in any of this, like in any of the press surrounding it, and they didn't want to take part in the Dyson report that was released. But then also there's kind of like examples of where in the past they have specifically emailed, they showed a load of emails that the Spencer had sent to the Daily Mail to be like, hey, do you want to come and photograph my mother on our estate for like Hello magazine and stuff like that. And so there is this kind of like weird duplicitous thing of expectations of what the press should, and actually I think it's very similar to what Meghan Markle has gone through, like that the fact that the press should only do kind of like positive things for us, promote our brand, pay us for stories and access and all of those kinds of things, and not do maybe some of the more the paparazzi stuff and the in-depth reporting stuff. Obviously the Bashir faking of documents and interview doesn't really fit into either of those, because he faked documents in order to get this access. And that is really shitty.
I mean, a lot of commentators have said that Diana... I mean, obviously, this isn't the idea that William conveyed when he criticised the BBC after the Dyson report was released. But a lot of commentators have said that Dinah was going to give an interview of this sort to somebody. You know, she was keen to actually. I think Prince Charles had actually given a similar interview, you know, previously, and she effectively wanted a chance to respond in public. And the BBC.
Oh my god! It was like, you remember the tracks that were like, that were "Fuck You, Bitch," "I Fuck You Right Now." Do you remember that song from like the late 2000s?
I don't.
One rapper did like a breakup song, and then somebody alleged that she was the girl that he did the breakup song about, and then she did a response rap.
Right.
That's a very niche reference, if anybody gets
it. That is quite niche. I mean, it is a little bit like sort of diss tracks where rappers go back 100%. And forth.
100%. It was a diss interview.
Yeah, it kind of was. You know, she wanted to have her say, and I think...
And she choreographed some of those lines.
Well, as I said, there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded. There's no way she came up. I mean, it's unlikely to me that she came up with that on the spur of the moment.
She knew that she wanted to share that at the very least.
Yeah, I mean, also just the way she looked super wounded and vulnerable after saying that. I think, you know, interviews are performances, right? So. So yeah, I think the idea that she was just a hapless victim in all of this, and not somebody who was also playing the game,
such a hapless victim,
is untrue. I think, and I agree with everything you said about the royals being celebrities and just wanting to have the press coverage entirely their own way. I mean, the royals don't have any legitimacy if they don't have a public life, and that means that they need to be scrutinized in certain ways.
Do you think their private lives like this should be scrutinised? Like, in like about marriages and things? I feel... which prince is it who hangs out with paedophiles?
Prince Andrew. Who had an association with Jeffrey Epstein.
Mm-hmm, sure. The private life of Prince Andrew, I think, is like... That's legitimate shit. Pizza Express? Sure, mate. And then there's... Like, I understand the fascination because we're an island of gossipers, and curtain twitchers, frankly. It's part of, like, the British character, I think, more than anything. But frankly, whether or not Diana and Charles are going through a divorce is none of your fucking business.
I disagree.
It's how I genuinely think.
Prince Charles is the heir to the throne. It is absolutely of public interest who he's married to and who might become future queen.
I don't really care. I know
you don't care personally, but that's obviously public interest. I mean, effectively, you know, it's every time an heir to the throne gets married, it's a public marriage. You know, it's not a...
Even Eugenie, what's her name?
Princess Eugene.
Yeah.
Well,
and the other one.
I think that if
the
you're...
The ones who wear the funny hats.
I think if you're not going to be, like, you know, climb up the throne, if you're not ever going to become king or queen... The argument is a bit more tenuous, but I mean, a lot of the royals do live effectively on, if not public money, then the Queen's money. And so I think that their general behaviour and conduct is kind of fair game. I mean, I appreciate there's just an element of pure gossip and you know, sort of voyeurism in the private lives of others that actually drives a lot of these stories. So I'm not saying it's entirely publicly spirited, this kind of reporting, but. Yeah, I think it's, and you know, if you, I sort of sympathise with Harry's, like Prince Harry's kind of a view on this, that he sometimes expresses or seems to express that he'd actually just rather be left alone and just be allowed to be a private citizen. And I think people should be able to leave the royal family and not be bothered ever again.
And then he launches an Apple exclusive TV series with Oprah.
Well, the difficulty
that's
for
the
old, his...
That's obviously what people do when they want to have a private life, isn't it?
Yeah, I think he's a hypocrite, and I think that the way him and Meghan Markle are comporting themselves in that regard it makes no sense, really. But in principle, yeah, you should be able to quit the royal family and not be bothered by the press again. But I guess it's debatable how easy that is, because once you've been a royal, you are an object of public fascination, whether, you know, whatever your role in the constitutional matters are. So yeah, should we talk about how this has been used a little bit to bash the BBC? I mean, you know, the usual crowd of like Tories who want to, well, you suspect they want to abolish the BBC.
They're coming up with a financial review next year.
Right.
They're due a reconstitution of what the license fee is going to look like for the next, is it 5, 6 years, something like that? So it will possibly have consequences. Yeah, what do you think? I don't know. It worries me because I want there to be a well-funded BBC at the centre of our journalism in this country, because I think it tends to, most of the time, do a really, really good job of pissing everybody off, which means it's doing a good job. Something like 80% of media consumed in the UK is BBC media, something like that.
So the BBC is the most watched, it's the most visited website in the UK behind, I think, Google, Amazon and YouTube.
And Pornhub. Oh.
I don't know if Pornhub was included in the stats.
It definitely wasn't. If it's not in the top 10, it definitely wasn't.
Well, I don't know. So yeah, I agree with you. I want the BBC to be well funded. I think that this scandal dates back so far that yes, it's right that the truth has caught up with some of the people who are involved with it. And I think also it's possible the freelancer, the graphics designer who was kind of whose career was definitely damaged by trying to expose this, I think it's right that he's compensated in some way.
Mm-hmm. Commemorative mug or something.
Yeah, maybe. But I don't think this says a great deal about how the BBC is run these days, because it was so long ago and things have changed a great deal. And we've already talked about how the BBC will report on itself, you know, with seemingly with a degree of enthusiasm, actually, for exposing its own wrongdoings, which, you know, creates these absurd stories where, you know, the BBC has been approached for comment and it's the BBC who's writing that news
article. Approached, yeah. I really enjoy it. And actually, broadly, I think it is. I said this before. I think that it is quite good at reporting on itself now. It used to be really awkward and quite bad at it. But now I think, oh, this is funny. But then it's actually quite good.
Yeah. It's sort of... that hasn't stopped people from saying, oh, this is an example of how, you know, how crap the BBC is and, you know, it needs to be reformed root and branch and all the rest of it. I just think that's rubbish, to be honest with you. I think the thing is the BBC has a worldview, and it's not politically unbiased. I mean, there's tons and tons of ways in which you could see that, but you probably don't want it to be. I mean, I don't think it's possible for a news organisation to be politically unbiased, but it is there to serve like a function in terms of how British society works. It's the leading public broadcaster. Even to, you know, reference one of our previous topics, when Dominic Cummings was talking about his contact with Laura Koonsberg, he did say, well, the BBC has a special role in how like British people consume news and media. It's not just any other news organisation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it is also there from the British state's point of view to wield a level of soft power, globally speaking. And it does have a global influence, which is important. I'm not somebody who thinks the license fee desperately needs to be maintained. I think that it is a slightly antiquated way of funding the BBC. And I think that maybe a subscription service would be a better way of doing things that is more in accordance with...
But then it becomes a private company. Right,
it does to some degree, I guess. Effectively, it's already you're not supposed to watch TV or access like iPlayer if you don't have a BBC license. So I don't. In many ways, I don't really see what the difference is between formalising that as a subscription service. Do you know what I mean? There's no suggestion that people won't still be able to read the BBC News website if they don't own a subscription.
But then it ceases to have like part of the BBC's remit is to reach everybody. And to provide media for those that wouldn't necessarily be reachable or viable for other media organisations, which is why there is a lot of like BBC Cymru is a thing, BBC Ulster, BBC the Scots Gaelic station, Alaba.
Exactly.
Like that's part that, and actually I would argue that is one of the most important things that the BBC does beyond just setting the political agenda of the country. And if you introduce a subscription service, those things arguably become less viable because they rely on a population that maybe isn't going to have the funds to be able to sign up for it, or isn't going to necessarily isn't going to choose that
subscription service, and so
it stops that type of media. And like the non-English language stuff is just one example of that. Also, a load of their educational resources and things.
A lot of your points apply to the license fee system, though. I mean, the license fee system is effectively a flat tax, so everyone has to pay. I think it's £159 a year now. That is more money proportionally for poor people than for rich people, which on its own is dubious, I think. I don't know, the trouble with funding it from, say, general taxation, which I suppose would be another option, is that, you know, in some ways it becomes even more prey to the political whims of whichever government's in charge, because, you know, they can, in theory, they could just raise or lower the budget for stuff as and when. But, you know, perhaps you could set up an independent body that was at arm's length from the government, and they could have a role in setting BBC budgets and the funds allocated to them. I don't know. I feel that would be...
I like that as well. That but also, there's loads of opportunities for, not privatisation of, but business opportunities for the BBC, like a global iPlayer, for example, that people can subscribe to. Like all of those Americans that bloody love Doctor Who... get them to pay a subscription for the iPlayer. They'll pay it.
Well, I think that's what they're trying to do with BritBox, which is made in collaboration with ITV.
Oh, is that what that is? Oh.
Yeah. And I think it's got what? It's got 2.3 million subscribers, which compared to Netflix is nothing, basically.
Yeah.
There is an argument that actually the BBC was in a great position to like launch a global streaming service, and just because the political will wasn't really there, it wasn't able to do it basically in time, and so Netflix stole a march on them. I don't know if that ship sailed, or if they're just the financial might of the BBC, because it's still like, you know, it's a serious global organization, would be enough for it to actually pursue that over time. I'm not really sure. But I mean, this all comes back to effectively the long-standing journalistic argument is there's no such thing as editorial independence without financial stability, basically. Like, you need some sort of independent funding in some way to actually stand up a news organisation like the BBC. But I think, seemingly, this plays back to your other point about, you know, news stories not necessarily affecting the direction of politics. But the Tories do seem a bit bent on clipping the wings of the BBC anyway. So perhaps whether or not this scan, you know, whatever this Dyson report turned up, they would still be looking to undermine it in some way going forward.
In some way, shape or form. Yeah. It just gives them ammunition. Shall we move on to George Floyd?
We can, yeah.
So it was over a year since... like a year ago, we were all in like hard lockdown. A lot of us were spending an awful lot more time on social media and stuff like Twitter and YouTube and things. And that video circulated the world. Do you remember watching it?
I actually still haven't watched it in full.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Well done on avoiding that horrific piece of media.
I think I've seen a minute of it, and I just thought I don't.
You get the. I think that's enough.
I've got the gist. I don't need to watch 9 minutes of a man being strangled to death effectively by someone's neck.
Basically, millions and millions of people across the world watched a guy get killed. That had such a profound effect on so many people, to the point where everybody decided, I'm going to go out into the streets, fuck lockdown, this is more important. And kind of like the Black Lives Matter movement had existed before George Floyd, but that video really was a catalyst around it.
It's very similar in that sense to the video of Rodney King being beaten up by LA police, which precipitated the LA riots. But, you know, it, as you say, because of the internet age and the fact the video was so quickly disseminated, I think events just moved faster and had a more widespread impact, I think, than the Rodney King killings. Oh, sorry, not killings, beating ups.
So we, of course, are two middle class white men in the UK, and so maybe it may feel like our lives are not quite affected by an African American man being killed in the lockdown of 2020 in the United States. What do you see? Because I think that there is a legacy of this that has changed. It's changed things that affect us. How do you think that this has changed things for you, if at all?
I don't know that it has changed anything for me personally, but the politically speaking, the language and the ideas of Black Lives Matter became a lot more salient in the UK after George Floyd was killed than they were beforehand. Obviously, you referenced that there were BLM protests in the UK. I sort of remember them going on. I was in a Sainsbury's and shortly after the George Floyd killing, and some of the shop workers were actually talking about having attended a Black Lives Matter rally just after that. So that I suppose in a way that's just kind of fascinating of its own accord, you know, that he was killed in Minneapolis by a policeman there, which is quite a long way from South London, where I overheard that conversation. But that aspect of it is interesting. Obviously, the one actual one of the most visible implications of it. You've referenced the removing of statues, and we obviously saw the Edward Colston statue be pulled down during a BLM march in Bristol because of his role with the Royal African Company, which invested in slave trading. And we also saw a lot of public figures doing the kneeling thing that was popularized by
the kneeling thing.
Yeah, popularized by Colin Kaepernick who was an American football player. Which I mean that sort of thing, the kneeling during the national anthem apparently was taken from what some American soldiers when they sort of visit the graves of fellow soldiers who've died in war, they'll kneel down as a mark of respect. Mm-hmm.
It's something that often happens at British or English Premier League games now as well.
Yes, it does.
To the point where it clashes with when we're taking part in international competitions, especially with Eastern European countries that maybe are less receptive to the Black Lives Matter movement, has created some conflict. I'm not just mainland Europe, but also other parts of the UK. Certain clubs and fans have reacted negatively to players deciding to take the knee.
Yeah, one thing I actually heard the other day that I thought was fascinating is that a friend of a friend was working in a school recently, and he saw that some of the kids, this was predominantly black school, some of the kids before they play football matches at lunchtime will actually kneel down, which I think is kind of fascinating.
I think that's really cool. Think that's really, really cool.
But some of it is surely to do with the fact that there are so many black players in the Premier League that it had had that salience. And I think it's fair to say the racial composition of the English fan base of the Premiership is much whiter than
the players. Fans of football are it's all of in the UK, isn't it? So we're 85% of our population is white, so that's going to be the case. But black and ethnic minority players over-index in English football teams at the very least.
I mean, how much? I know you've referenced that, like, there's been booing at the kneeling at the start of games, players kneeling down. I find it hard to tell how widespread this is. I mean, I'm sure that there are some fans that boo and jeer and don't particularly, think maybe that it's virtue signaling or just don't really agree with
the All Lives Matter. Well, I think a lot of it comes from just your behavior, to be honest.
How widespread is it? I mean, I'm sure there's quite a few surveys where you say to people, do you agree that with racial equality in the round, or like the Black Lives Matter their goals in terms of racial equality? A majority of the British population do, don't they?
So, yeah, it's very easy to say that you're pro this is the point in the phrase Black Lives Matter, right? Because the idea that you are against black lives is meant to sound preposterous. Mm. And when people decline to say it, for example, especially in the 2016, I remember, especially in the Republican field, lots of people were asked, "Do you believe that Black Lives Matter?" And it was so difficult for them to just say Black Lives Matter. They'd always say Black Lives Matter, and the closest that you would get is Black Lives Matter, but of course all lives matter, blue lives matter, blah blah blah, shut up. But I think it's very difficult to say, it's very different to saying, oh yeah, of course I believe in like equality for people who aren't white. That's a very easy thing to say, but as soon as they are affronted with it and they see it in a thing that they see as their own, like watching a football match, and all of a sudden they have to think about race relations at the beginning of every time that they're watching a game that they play, that is inevitably going to be, there is going to be pushback there, especially when all of these, there's lots of gammons who watch football.
Yeah, your own prejudices are coming out.
Yeah,
and this fair. Jazzer.
I don't care. But that's an inconvenience for them. But that's the point of protest. Is to make you think about a thing, or to make you reconsider a thing, maybe when you didn't want to, or maybe when your existence is not affected by it, and so you don't have to think about it.
And that's the reason
why people do stuff like take the knee. And I think that the booing and the jeering is one thing that is more common than one would want it to be, I think, but certainly the way that certain members of my family talk about it, they don't like it. Mm. Like, they wouldn't say that they're against Black Lives Matter, but they certainly don't like the fact that it's brought into sport. But sport, my friends, has always been political.
Yeah, but I mean, you described it as protest, and in some context, taking the knee is protest. But it's effectively an FA backed initiative, isn't it? Taking the knee at the start.
It would have to be. Yeah,
it's not. I mean, they're objecting to to racism in the round, but it's not as if it's not an act of bravery on their part. It's the corporations in general are fully paid up supporters of Black Lives Matter.
But I think that is an example of how George Floyd's death has changed stuff, even for us couple of white blokes in England, because all of a sudden every single company, every single institution, everyone had to overtly show how they were pro-equality and anti-racist, and that included the FA allowing players to take the knee in the face of the stuff that was happening, that happened in the US, and then the protests that happened across the world. Like, every single company now, every single large company has some kind of initiative to be able to provide some kind of reparations, be it through employment or diversity and equality.
I don't know that everyone would consider it reparations, which is a word that has a particular meaning in this debate, right?
Sure, that's fair. But like, wants to be able to be seen to be not just pro-equality, but anti-racist. And that's something that we see a lot more, kind of like every single...
I think that George Floyd's death did accelerate that process. I think that diversity initiatives, not necessarily purely focused on ethnic diversity, but on sexual diversity and gender equality and whatnot, were quite common in big companies anyway. I think there was a general corporate drift in this direction.
But now, Jimmy, they have funding.
Possibly. I mean, I think one of the stories from last year that you just remind me of is that Greene King the pub chain in the UK was actually did announce last year that they would be paying, and they called them reparations in the form of like money to black focused charities last year. Interesting calling it reparations, I think, just because the whole conversation about whether Western states have a moral duty to pay money back to either black communities in their own countries or to, other states that were affected during colonial times. That's a whole other kettle of fish. I think, obviously, companies felt that there was enough public pressure to justify, you know, making these moves in various ways. And a lot of them have been criticized for the initiatives being quite thin, really, and unlikely to have a big impact, or it being virtue signaling. But I mean that both from like left and right. Obviously, the right are saying you're just doing this to pander to like left-wing activists, and left-wing people would sometimes say you're just like mouthing the words, but you don't really mean it, basically.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, as if right-wing activists aren't pandered to.
yeah, that's true.
What a ridiculous thing to say. Probably.
Well, no, it's not ridiculous, because in many cases it will be true. I think the criticism is accurate.
Yeah, no, but I don't think I feel like it's an invalid criticism, because I feel like it implies that it's something that only happens on the left wing, quote.
That's true. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Obviously isn't. Probably one of the most tangible things, especially in America, to come out of the George Floyd's death is the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which Biden promised would be passed within a year after his death. He's failed on that promise.
but he's working on it, right?
But he isn't working on it. The Senate is working on it,
right?
At the
okay.
And they're trying to make it bipartisan. But by making it bipartisan in the U.S. Senate at the moment means they found one guy from the Republican Party to back this bill.
Technically
still bipartisan, very true. But this is going to have I mean, obviously the federal government has limited capability to legislate for non-federal institutions like local police. It's certainly going to go towards, but it is going to attempt this bill to go towards changing the tone of the way that police work, by not giving them qualified immunity is the term that is used, has made it very difficult to convict officers across the United States when they act unlawfully while in uniform. The introduction of more body worn and dashboard cameras is data shows that police and assailant behavior improves when those are worn across the country.
By assailants, you mean the people the police are interacting with and potentially arresting?
Yeah, is that what assailants means? I don't actually know.
Well, it depends on whether they've done anything, I guess.
Okay. Cool.
Not entirely clear.
And they're also trying to stop it's not defund the police, but it's stop funding the police with military-grade weaponry.
There is this phenomenon in the US where, because the US military spends so much money on gear, and a lot of it has to be decommissioned and replaced so that they could, because they're spending more money on gear, newer, shinier gear, a lot of that gets sold off as like army surplus to police forces, right? So you have police forces that have, you know, so some of them probably have more military equipment than actual militaries in other countries. So that seems bad to me. I'm not an expert in policing or law enforcement, but I think having police run around with like military grade kit sends a bad message, and probably doesn't contribute to the police being more effective in enforcing the law.
Shock horror.
Yeah, that's my cutting edge analysis, Jazza, which I know you come for.
I loved it. It was really good. shall we wrap up?
I think we probably should. Where can I find you on the internet, Jazza?
Jazza John on all social media platforms. You can also find me at Jazza John Gaming, where I'm streaming Final Fantasy X, a game from 20 years ago that I sometimes cry at live on stream. enjoy.
Something to look forward to, I think. You can find me at JDE Nichols on Twitter, or at Jimmy at rightdishonorable.com if you want to use an email.
What was the last thing you cried at, Jimmy?
Last thing I cried at? I'm not really much of a crier, I'm afraid, Jazza.
Oh, I mean, I'm sure everybody listening is shocked.
I mean, I feel like crying sometimes when I see the audience figures for this podcast, but that hasn't quite broken me yet.
Great. On that note, bye.
Bye-bye.